I added one more podcast to the giant podcast bin. Now you have plucked that podcast out and started listening.
I took my microphone and found some human folk. Then I recorded all the noises while we spoke.
My name is Adam Buxton,
I'm a man. I want you to enjoy this, that's the plan.
How are you doing, listeners? Adam Buxton here. Very nice to be with you. I can't hide the fact that I'm feeling unusually up-tempo due to the great, great weather. As you'll know, I'm a simple man who is affected by these kinds of things very deeply. And I'm looking at a lot of dandelions, some bluebells, cherry blossom, buzzy bees. My beautiful dog friend Rosie is up ahead, sniffling, snuffling and scampering. And enjoying, weather-wise at least, an idyllic day. Just checking the forecast for the coming week. Golden balls with a bit of cloud. It's mainly golden balls. Look at that. Okay, look, I won't go on too much about the weather. Let's get into the meat of the introduction. Some people get very upset about a rambly introduction. I got a message last week from someone saying, you just wasted 5 minutes of my life with that intro. 5 minutes. I mean, that's a very important person there whose time is extremely valuable, but I couldn't help thinking that if their time is that valuable, why are they flushing more valuable seconds down the toilet by composing that message and sending it to me? I don't know. Anyway, here is what I hope is a useful intro for this week's guest on podcast number 75, American musician Eleanor Friedberger. Let me tell you a little bit about Eleanor. She and her brother Matthew formed the core of the Fiery Furnaces, a brilliantly strange indie band that was together from 2000 to 2011 and are, according to the internet, simply on hiatus as Matthew and Eleanor pursue solo projects. For those of you not familiar with the Fiery Furnaces, I thought that I would just cobble together a very short series of musical moments from some of their albums, just to give you a very vague sense of what they're about. Not suggesting these are their greatest moments, they're just some moments. Go moments.
Over my past, only the sadness stays.
Fiery Furnaces moments there. You will find a list of the specific tracks in the description to this podcast, along with other related links. Now, Eleanor's solo records are perhaps overall a bit more straightforward than the Fiery Furnaces, but no less enjoyable. Her song, My Mistakes, is one of my favourite songs of all time. Here's a bit of My Mistakes. I love it. I also love the video for My Mistakes. It's directed by New York-based artist Sarah Magenheimer, also linked in the description for this podcast. And it includes grainy video footage of Eleanor shot when she was about 10 years younger at that point, preparing to go out on a date with her then-boyfriend, Britt Daniel, lead singer of Spoon, who regular listeners will know I'm a big fan of, and they appeared on episode 47 of the podcast. Now, I mention that only because at one point in our conversation, Eleanor expressed her frustration with music journalists and with people like me who find it necessary to bring up aspects of an artist's private life in that way. But as you'll hear, I do my best to argue the case for finding it interesting without, I hope, being disrespectful. Now, my conversation with Eleanor was recorded one dark, cold afternoon in February 2016 before she played an acoustic show at East London's Moth Club. The recording has been sat in the backlog file because I'm a big fan of Eleanor's, and I came away from our meeting, which was the first time I'd met Eleanor, feeling that I hadn't really done a particularly good job talking to her. But then I listened back the other day and I really enjoyed it. So I thought you might enjoy it too, especially if you're a music fan, which I know many of you are, and especially because now Eleanor has a new record out, Rebound. So despite being a little late, it seemed like a good moment to put this out. I was listening to Rebound on a loop yesterday. Very good. I think it's one of Eleanor's best. Here's a little moment from the recent single, Make Me a Song. 253 octaves, the middle C. There's a B flat where a wave every year. I could love you more. I could love you more. That's Make Me a Song from Rebound, Eleanor's new album. But our conversation back in 2016 began on ground that will be familiar to regular listeners, with me asking Eleanor about negative criticism before giving her a couple of gifts. I'll be back with more Hot Waffle and recommendations at the end of the podcast, but right now, here we go! Unless you're a musician that massively crosses over, then fans tend to be very loyal and respectful, don't you find?
No. I think people say like, well, look at our stupid hair or whatever. You know, I think people always find a way to be mean.
Are you aware of getting comments like that, though?
A little bit, yeah.
Look at her stupid hair.
Yes.
Is that one you've got?
Something like that, yeah.
What else? Was it worse when you were with the Fiery Furnaces? Or is it worse now you're on your own?
The comments? I don't know. No, I really do try. I'm kind of joking. I try hard not to look at that stuff.
Right. You don't want to encourage it.
My brother, on the other hand, loved looking at the negative stuff like that. He really fed off of that.
Did he
negativity.
Genuinely, because he's thick-skinned or he just couldn't, he was like, he liked to pick at the scab?
Maybe a little bit of both, probably picking at the scab.
Because I never believe people who say that they're not affected by those things. My
right.
comedy wife, Jo, we used to do a radio show together, and there was a time when we were at a station called XFM, and he would look at the computer, and we'd get like just loads of negative comments.
Right.
Shut up, play some records, you're twats.
Right, right.
He reckoned that it didn't affect him. He was like, I don't mind. But I couldn't deal with it. I couldn't concentrate right. on the show if I saw any of them.
Maybe that he was a sociopath.
I think that might be part of it. I mean, there's a lot
I was talking about last night, the difference, if there was a difference between sociopaths and psychopaths.
What's your understanding?
Well, I was saying that a psychopath is not a real, like, medical term. I think that's just kind of like something maybe someone said in a movie or something.
Okay.
Sociopath is like an actual like psychiatric term for
right.
somebody who doesn't care about the comments.
Okay, okay. Someone who is able to read YouTube comments with impunity.
Yeah.
Like
my brother would revel in bad reviews. Revel and, you know, just love it.
He said, Meanwhile, he would...
But
he
just
would,
laughing.
He would go into his bedroom and he would cry.
I don't think so.
Are you right? Really?
I don't know.
Mentioning psychopaths and sociopaths.
Do you have candies right there?
Yeah, I do. I bought you some gifts.
Oh, thanks.
And I'm the kind of person that is so unimaginative that when they buy people gifts, they just buy things that they themselves like and hope
that
the
other... Oh, I'm the same. My gift giving is it's always just for me.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes I buy multiples of the same thing. Right. If I buy something nice, I'll immediately buy another one and think, well, that'll be a good present.
Right.
So I've bought you three of my favorite things. Talking about psychopaths and sociopaths, have you read this book? John Ronson,
no.
So You've Been Publicly Shamed.
No.
He's a British journalist. And he's been on this podcast. He's a friend as well. And he wrote a book called The Psychopath Test, which was, one of his big hits as an author.
Well, that's a real coincidence that I mentioned that.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of that kind of chat within that book.
Mm-hmm.
But it goes into the whole world of people categorizing mental illnesses and
right.
the money that there is to be made from it and
right.
how dangerous it can be
right.
to...
Hearing people say, like, he's on the spectrum. Like, I mean, we never heard that. I never heard that, you know, a couple of years ago. That to me seems like a real new thing.
That's right. I talked to John about that exact thing. This is his latest book. So
but who knew that almost everyone I know is
right,
on
is
the
on,
spectrum?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, this is what John and I chatted about.
Right.
I think pretty much everyone is, don't you? I mean, everyone is more or less, and the older you get, the nuttier you get.
Yeah, I guess.
You pick up just a load of neuroses and... ticks and kinks and
right
and you are and people distinguish themselves by being variously good at hiding them as far as I can tell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people are brilliant at it,
yeah,
and they look totally normal.
Yeah.
And other people wear their peculiarities on their sleeves a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they're artists, so they have an excuse, you know what I mean?
Right.
Anyway, this is a book called So You've Been Publicly Shamed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about the whole world of online shaming and Twitter storms and people saying the wrong thing and just finding themselves with their lives totally destroyed by people condemning them for saying that.
Right.
Know? It's it's really fascinating. Is that the kind of book that you might read?
It's funny because I suffer from insomnia sometimes. And now I know myself well enough to know when it's why it's happening, when it's happening, and all that kind of stuff. And it's all about, you know, just being overly anxious about certain things. And I fall asleep immediately, but I wake up at 3 or 4 in the morning and stay up for like a few hours. And I should get up and read a book maybe when that happens. But instead, I just toss and turn, and my mind just like is going to explode from too many thoughts and things like that. But I feel like, I don't know if this is going to make it worse. Reading this
well,
make it worse.
I mean, it's pulse quickeningly horrific.
Yeah, but will this make my anxieties?
I would say it would
worse.
Intensify
it's,
them. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, ultimately, in my mind, the whole book is a kind of a plea for tenderness. You know, in the net age, I think it feels like early days for a lot of social networking and people getting used to interacting with each other online, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think people are gradually getting used to the fact that these things matter, their words matter, and
right.
their actions online really have terrible consequences sometimes. Anyway, so that's
thank you.
A gift for you. Little plug for John there as well. I bought you a picnic bar. This is my current favorite.
I've never had one of those.
Chocolate candy treat.
I'm not allergic to peanuts.
Are you not? Good. Otherwise, yeah, you'd be stuffed with this gift and the next one.
I love peanuts.
I mean, this is something I came to late in life because I did not like peanuts when I was younger.
Okay.
I just thought that any kind of nuts just seemed too healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Same with raisins. I was like, mate, you've got no place in a enjoyable snack treat. What are you doing? I just wanted solid chocolate and
I might eat that while we're talking.
Caramel. Do it. I like to put them in the fridge.
Okay.
And then bite into them so they shatter.
Okay.
What's your favorite sweet snack normally?
I don't have a massive sweet tooth. Lately, I've been eating these ginger chews, they're called. And it's just like
cubes.
A chewy ginger. Yeah.
Very
into
nice.
Into that.
Like
somehow
it.
That seems healthy.
Well, this is the healthiest of
oh, my
the,
gosh.
You got some...
More raisins.
Midnight jumbo raisins and cashew nuts.
That's really up my alley.
The only thing with that, I don't know about you, but it causes some incredible... airborne toxic events.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so...
I look forward to eating that on the train up to Manchester tomorrow.
Well, there you go. Train is ideal. Train or an aeroplane, because then you can chuff away with relaxation without anyone knowing. I've been a fan of your stuff for a while. You're one of the artists who I like more and more the more I hear and the more I find out about them.
Thank you. Thank you. That's really...
Because I was sort of told...
The opposite is a real drag.
Yeah. Well, it does happen, though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Sometimes you're into stuff and you read interviews or whatever and you think, oh...
Yeah. I tend to not read too much about the people that I admire or who I think I admire reason.
Right. Yeah. I read a piece for The Quietus where you went through some of the albums that you really love.
They let me kind of make up a category. The records I've listened to the most times from beginning to end, meaning not like, oh, I like tracks 3 and 4, but it was actually like I put it on, I listened to the whole thing, and then often listened to the whole thing again without stopping.
And some of the ones that
And there's
stood
not
out.
That many. You know, like, when you think about it, when you give yourself that, it's actually not that easy.
I think one that springs to mind for me, a more modern one, is Teenager of the Year by Frank Black.
Okay. I haven't heard that one.
Do you like the Pixies and Frank Black and that kind of thing?
I like them, but they've never been, like, one of my bands. I don't own a Pixies album. But I've been surrounded by people who love the Pixies, and I've seen the Pixies, and I know all... You know, that's one of those bands where, like, I saw them on one of their reunion tours, but it was probably over 10 years ago now. And, like, you see a band, you don't have one of their records, but you know every single song they play.
Yeah, sure. I mean, in my mind, their music, and especially his solo stuff, is quite similar to yours.
Mm-hmm.
But I would imagine that it's the same for musicians that it is with comedians, when people sort of say, I tell you who you'd really like is this other comedian who does something similar. And you think, no, I don't like them at all.
Right.
Because, no, A, they're too similar, and I feel threatened by them. And B, you kind of tend to gravitate towards otherness, don't you? Things that are not like yourself.
When you were telling me about your YouTube show, I almost said, oh, that reminds me of... And I stopped myself.
Who were you thinking of, though? I mean, I don't get offended by it.
Well, I was like, oh, it's kind of like Eugene Merman, who does a lot of stuff kind of like...
You see, I don't feel threatened by him because he's American and he's not here all the time.
Okay.
But yeah, I've been told that before. And in fact, I was put on a bill with Eugene when David Cross came and did some shows at the 100 Club.
Uh-huh.
And it was Kristen Schaal and Eugene Merman and myself and... Mm-hmm. Todd Barry.
Oh, cool.
So, kindred spirits, I think. I felt, like, very honored to be included with them.
The last time that happened to me that I remember, this woman came up to me and said, oh, have you heard this guy Bob Trimble? And, like, totally obscure, but this label had reissued one of his records. She said, the song My Mistakes sounds exactly like this song, the first song on his album. And I was really curious because I was interested in her opinion, you know, and I went and listened to it, and I was like, this doesn't sound anything like it. But I loved it. I loved it so much.
Cool.
I was just like, so sometimes it's nice.
So some of the records you picked out, though, are some of the ones that I really love. I mean, Van Morrison, Astral Weeks.
Uh-huh.
That's obviously an album that tops a lot of polls.
I know. Well, that's why I was a little bit embarrassed by my list, because they're all very famous, mostly very famous albums.
Yeah, but it's a good example of a record that still feels like your secret, because you don't hear it everywhere you go.
That's true.
It's not used on commercials. It's not used in films.
Right.
It's not on the radio, really.
Right. And that's an album that I've been listening to consistently since I first heard it, probably when I was 14. And I there aren't very many albums that I've been listening to every year for that many years, you know, and that's definitely one of them. And he's somebody who, like, you hear on the radio, but like you said, you don't hear that record on the radio. And now I've, like, gravitated. I'm a huge Van Morrison fan. And now, because I know that record so well, I don't listen to it so much. So now I've, like, listened to some of his other more obscure records that I, you know, like Veed and Fleece and Common One, or I was just like, what? You know, and that's the kind of stuff I can also just put on and leave on and just play over and over again and never get sick of.
Did you buy the new remaster of Astral Weeks?
I did not.
What kind of nerd are you, Van Morrison?
I recently got a copy as a gift of, like, a, you know, vinyl reissue, but it doesn't have, like, but I don't know if it's
so
special.
Not, right, so you're not someone who
the mere existence in the public realm of alternate versions of tracks on Astral Weeks doesn't fill you with vibrating excitement.
I didn't know that they exist. Now I'll go and listen to them now that you mentioned it, because recently I heard some different versions of stuff on Moondance that I'd never heard, and I was like, holy shit, this is amazing, you know, but I'll seek that out now that you mentioned it.
You know, I mean, it's not, you probably won't be listening to them over and over again.
You never know.
Yeah. But they are quite different. His phrasing and his voice is an instrument in itself, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. Well, yeah, I heard a different version of Into the Mystic, which is a song I've heard a gazillion times.
Oh, that's quite a song.
And just hearing him just sing a few things differently, which to me was a revelation completely as a singer. Like, I was just...
Yeah.
I mean, I've sung along with him so many times and copied his phrasing exactly. So then to hear him sing one line that you know so well differently was really fun to hear.
Yes, it's like you're getting a private concert or you're... Because I don't know if you've ever had this fantasy, but sometimes when people talk about time travel, the main thing I think about is going back and seeing some of my favorite bands when they were just playing tiny venues, you know, and also recording some of those songs, you know. I mean, I'm quite a massive nerd in that way. I watch all the classic albums, documentaries and things like that. I love all that shit. Yeah. And as soon as you get a balding guy going through and raising faders on a mixing desk with the original masters, I get very sweaty and excited. And when you hear those alternate versions, it does feel as if you're eavesdropping on the session.
Right.
My friend Danny, he's got these new Dylan reissues where there's like 25 versions of Like a Rolling Stone.
Right. Well, I recently heard like the two other versions of Went to See the Gypsy. That's like one of my favorite Dylan songs for some odd reason. And just hearing those two versions, I listened to them over and over. I mean, it's just, yeah, I don't know what it is about those alternate takes. I think it is just because you're so used to what you know. And then when you hear that there was a different way, you know, it's just like mind-blowing.
Yeah, it's thrilling.
Really is. And the George Harrison stuff, like his demos are like, oh, those are my favorite. Because you hear those, you know, Phil Spector produced that album, and then you hear these stripped down versions of just George playing guitar and singing in his beautiful voice, and it's just like heaven to hear that.
Are you sufficiently nerdy that you would listen to interviews just with George? Like, there's a guy, oh, I forget his name. I'll get Fact Checking Santa to interrupt the podcast and let me know his name. But this guy recorded a load of interviews in the 60s and 70s with massive stars. He did a load of stuff with John Lennon.
Hello, Fact Checking Santa here. George Harrison was interviewed by New York DJ Howard Smith in May 1970, a few months before the release of his solo album, All Things Must Pass. The recording can be heard on the Smith tapes. Merry Christmas!
And George Harrison is just completely mind-blowingly candid about all kinds of things that any sort of artist would never be candid about these days, you know, especially money.
Mm-hmm.
And he's talking numbers, and he's talking about how much he owes the tax man. I mean, he's always going on about money, wasn't he, George Harrison?
Right.
But he's talking about people writing him begging letters for money and how he's actually given some guy wrote him a sob story about how shit his life was. So Harrison ended up sending him like $25,000 or something. Crazy.
I'm surprised they didn't get to include that in the Scorsese documentary that he made for HBO.
Oh, yeah.
Which I loved, but I'm surprised they didn't access those interviews.
Yeah. Anyway, Van Morrison, yeah, love the guy. However, he's a good example of someone you maybe wouldn't want to meet in real life.
Exactly. Yeah. Perfect example. Like, I've never been one of those people like, oh, I want to meet my heroes. Like, I have nothing to say, you know. And I would love to see him perform. I've never seen him perform, but I definitely don't need to go and shake his hand or whatever one might do.
Clean up his poo after he's pooed in the middle of your hotel room.
Is that something he's known to do?
I've heard that story.
Well, I haven't heard that. I don't
want
to know.
I don't know. There's a lot of stories flying around. Probably they're totally untrue, and it's just based on people getting bent out of shape because he wasn't sufficiently excited to meet them.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Is that real melody?
Heaven's in my phone charger.
What?
I left it right there.
Woof.
Did you see it?
What?
Have you got it?
What?
charger gone?
What?
Where's my phone charger? What? The battery's about to die. It was on the table.
What?
Round and round in their heads go the chord progressions, the empty lyrics, and the impoverished fragments of tune. And boom goes the brain box at the start of every bar. At the start of every bar. Boom goes the brain box.
Cold in this room.
It is cold. Yeah, we're sat in a kind of dingy old, it's like a working men's club, and this is the upstairs bit, all red upholstered bonquettes and wood paneling, but there's no lights on
and there's no heat.
There's no heat. The sun's going down outside, so I'm actually struggling to see Eleanor now. I've got quite bad eyesight anyway. So do you mind me asking you about fiery furnaces, or is it something that makes your heart sink when...
No, but sometimes now when people ask me about, I genuinely don't remember lots of things, and I don't want that to sound like I'm trying to avoid the question, but it's been, you know, we started playing together 16 years ago, and so sometimes it's hard to remember specific things.
Yeah, of
course. But I'll try to answer anything you ask me.
Matthew is the name of your brother.
That's true.
And Matthew encouraged Eleanor's music ambitions by buying her a guitar and a drum kit.
True.
Eleanor's father and Matthew's father, because they're siblings, was English. Their mother was American.
True, she's Greek-American.
Eleanor was the catcher on a softball team when she was a child, an indication, she has said, that she has the necessary leadership skills to be a band leader.
Not just a child, but a teenager even.
Why is that a position of... I don't know about sport or softball or anything like that.
Do you know who the catcher is? The catcher sits behind...
It's someone who actually catches the ball.
Sits behind home plate.
Yeah.
You know, the pitcher throws the ball to the catcher. But the catcher is the one who supposedly calls the plays and lets the whole... You know, everyone on the field is looking at the catcher. So the catcher is... got his or her hands up and saying, like, you know, out at second, blah, 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 telling everyone what to do.
Uh-huh.
I do attribute playing sports and being, more importantly, being good at sports is, like, helping me and for the rest of my life kind of
something that gave you confidence.
Oh, for sure. I mean, the confidence building, yeah. Yes, very important.
And I suppose...
And playing with other people, being in team sport especially, is like being in a band.
Uh-huh. Learning how to win and lose gracefully, graciously.
Yeah. The confidence thing is really the biggest part, you know, because I was, like, just naturally gifted for some reason, like, kicking a ball and, like, kicking a ball up in the air so it would go in the goal. And when you were a little kid, it wasn't just rolling on the ground, but if it went up in the air, like, it was impossible to stop. And having that when you're 5 years old, it really ingrains this thing in you that is, it was lucky for me, I suppose.
Well, it was always my dream to be able to make a ball go where I wanted it to with my foot.
But I mean, it's terrible. And I know for the people who weren't necessarily as good, it's, you know, equally bad, you know. And I was the kid, like, we'd be separated in school, like, and it would be like mostly the boys and then two or three horrible losers put with like most of the girls and then like one or two girls put with most of the boys. And I was one of those girls. And, you know, really, it made a big impact on me.
Mm. You see, I was one of those horrible losers who was picked last for the team.
But look at you now.
Look at me now, exactly. And look at the fact that music has forged an alliance between us two, and we could have been mortal enemies. Staring over at you thinking, she's one of the jocks.
Well, right, and I think I was lucky enough to grow up in an environment where I was friends with a lot of jocks, I'm putting my fingers in quotation marks, but who were also equally interested in music. And by the time I got to college, I found there was a bigger gap between, you know, you either liked music or you were good at sports and you were like a frat boy. But I always was looking for those people who equally liked sports and music. And they do exist.
Yes.
Robert Pollard is a good example. He's a real jock.
Yeah, of course they exist. I mean, it's like a lazy thing to say, isn't it? Is that it's like when comedians say, oh, you can't have a good-looking comedian. because it's not for you. You know, comedy's for us misfits, us ugly people.
Right.
And when a good-looking comedian, whether they're male or female, comes along, everyone's like, oh, that's not cool, that's not fair.
Right.
You know.
No, it's nice, you know, bold. To be well-rounded.
It is nice, isn't it? I would love it. Okay, when you were in the fiery furnaces, obviously a part of the interest for journalists and I suppose for fans was the mystery of the dynamic between you and your brother, right? Is that fair to say?
Well, I don't know what people are... I can't comment on that.
Well, here's a quote from a Guardian article from 2003.
I think people wanted to... Not, sorry to interrupt you. I think people wanted to put us at odds against each other.
Right.
And that's not mysterious. That's just people trying to create drama and something interesting to write about, you know? But I don't think our relationship as brother and sister was that unusual, you know? Like, he's an older brother. He bullied me as a kid. We were also best buddies at times. And, you know, he's domineering because he's my older brother. I don't think that's so unusual.
But you don't have any lasting mental scars.
Well, I think I do.
Other than the normal ones.
I think I have plenty. And I have literal scars, you know. My brother was a very sort of... I mean, I've talked about this before, so it's, I'm not betraying.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, he actually stabbed me with a pocket knife when I was a child, you know.
How old were you?
I was maybe 3 or 4.
Oh, my, that's too young to be stabbed by a pocket knife.
Yeah, I mean, well, my parents were the ones to blame for, like, to give, you know, it was a little, small Swiss Army pocket knife.
Oh, come on. And how old is he then? He's how old, much
he
older than you?
He would have been, he's 4 years older. So I'd say he was either 8 or 9, and I was 4 or 5, something like that.
Flipping egg, Tucker.
I mean, he was very aggressive.
I guess.
Yeah. I mean, he still claims it was an accident, but it wasn't. He was holding the knife over me, you know.
Right.
But I mean, I would love to talk about how frustrating it is that people who are supposed to be writing about music are not writing about music. They're only trying to find some kind of personal story to tell. And is that because people don't actually want to read about music, or is that because music is so difficult to write about and we only want to read like a gossip rag? And it just it seems to be more and more the case.
I think there's an assumption that people don't really care about music that much.
But that's not true. And
of course
that's so
it's not,
not
true.
True.
No, but on TV, for example, the wisdom is don't have bands on because people will switch off.
But I'm talking about places where music is actually supposed to be written about.
Right.
Like a music website, for instance, that starts with a P. You know, like...
Yeah, yeah.
They don't really write about music, even. The actual music.
Sure. But I think that all those places, you know, because even shows that are ostensibly about music, people get cold feet on TV and think, oh, well, we can't have certain bands on because they're too difficult. They'll be too challenging and people will turn over. And I think maybe it's like that for journalists who are writing supposedly about music. They think, well, we need something to hook people in. We can't just say, oh, look, there's this band, because people go, oh, it's just another band, I'm not interested.
Right.
You need to hang it on some kind of salacious peg. That sounds like a character from the new Star Wars movie.
Salacious peg. But it, the sad bit is that usually those things, they're not that salacious, and they're actually just really kind of boring, and who cares? They're not interesting either, because we're not that interesting people, you know? Like, it's just not... Mentioning my ex-boyfriend, who, you know, I've been apart from for over 6 years, is that worth mentioning? You know, like, I've had a lot of boyfriends since then. Like, why do you need to mention that again?
I have to say that it was interesting to me. It was interesting to me because I had no clue. I was a Spoon fan of the band Spoon.
Oh, yeah.
For a long time without knowing there was any connection between you two.
Uh-huh.
Because you had a relationship with Britt Daniel. The lead singer, right?
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was just sort of... in fact, I think I found out because I saw you in Sydney and you mentioned it before playing one of the songs.
Oh, that's right. I used to play one of his songs.
Yeah, yeah. So I was like, oh, there you go. That's interesting. I didn't know that. And then I found out that he'd even written a song about you, for you, Anything You Want, which is a song I really like.
Mm-hmm.
So it was enjoyable for me to have those universes intertwine in that way.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know you'd gone out with Alex Kapranos from Franz Ferdinand.
Uh-huh.
So that's interesting as well. And it's like, he wrote a song as well. for you. So it's fun for a music nerd to know these things. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I guess.
You can understand that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it must be weird for you, obviously. Especially if you haven't...
Yeah. No, I was just going back to what we were talking about originally, like, that, you know, journalists playing up a sort of negative kind of dynamic between my brother and I, and I'm just trying to put it back to, like, oh, is that the same as mentioning an ex-boyfriend or something? And I guess it's part of the same.
I suppose it is the same. I suppose what I'm trying to say is from the other side, from the reader's side, mm-hmm. I don't think you can always dismiss those things as being completely meaningless.
Right. But as I was going back to, like, Van Morrison again, I've heard that he's kind of an asshole, you know? So I don't want to read anything. I don't need nothing... You could tell me about him is going to change how I feel about his music, you know? And it's
nothing.
Not going to add... I don't think so. And I don't want it to, you know?
No, I
either.
Agree.
So I don't care about who he went out with or his sister, what, you know, it's just, it doesn't... So I want people to feel that way about me, too. I mean, it's the same as a more extreme example. Like, I'm obsessed with Woody Allen movies. I don't want to know anything, except I just want to know about them. I just want to see the movie and have the movie still in my mind. I don't want to know about his private life.
Absolutely. I feel the same way as you. And of course, objectively, empirically, there shouldn't be any real... Yeah, there's lots of brilliant artists who are thoroughly mediocre human beings,
mm-hmm.
and it shouldn't detract from the value in their art. But it's harder and harder, don't you find? Like, have you seen a Woody Allen movie since the allegations about him have been
public?
I have.
Yeah.
And did it feel strange? Did you think about that at all? Did it
as
color
I was
your
watching
experience?
It? No, mean, I don't think they're as good as some of the movies sure. that I love that you know
yeah.
that were before those allegations, but. I'm not sitting there watching him thinking about what he's done or hasn't done.
Yeah, you're involved in the work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just because I flagged it so many times, I'm going to read the quote. That,
okay.
As she watches her brother, Eleanor, 27, raises her eyes and exhales softly. Not for the last time today, her face arranges itself into an expression pitched between incredulity and weary resignation. In fact, she spends a fair percentage of our interview looking like that. She also has a habit of repeating her brother's more outré ideas in a deadpan voice, giving the impression they rank among the most idiotic things she has ever heard.
Oh my God, where the fuck did you find that?
He's a good writer, Alex Petridis.
Petridis. Remember him. That's funny. I mean, that I have to say, looking back on one of the things that I did really dislike about being in the band with my brother was doing interviews with him. I mean, that was torture.
There are some...
Torture.
Right, there's interviews with you on YouTube, and there is a kind of crackly chemistry there.
I mean, we could, if we were both in a good mood, it would be fun, and I could, you know, be the straight man, and we had this little thing, you know. But just sitting, you know, like, it was a waste of time in the end. Like, I should have done an interview and he should have done an interview and we could have done more interviews that way. It's a lot of torture to have this partner, as maybe you know about, like, to just sit and wait and then listen and then try and come up with something else to say. And it's just...
It's hard.
Unless you're on and you're doing a routine. Like I said, sometimes we were able to do and that was fun. Otherwise, it's just kind of like, just torture.
It can be really tough, but but do you think that sense of torture was something that you were able to use on stage then? Because sometimes there's a clip on YouTube of you looking quite irritated with each other, mm-hmm. but then you launch into a version of Police Sweater Blood Vow,
uh-huh.
which is great, and it's really crackly in the same way that the relationship had been crackly before. Then you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's not a question so much as a thing that I just said.
No, I think I'm sure you're right. You know, I can remember feeling a lot of tension on stage and that feeling exhilarating, and then other times, you know, feeling relaxed. We sometimes, you know, my brother is the kind of person that, you know, his mood, you know, affects the whole room kind of thing. And a lot of people are like that.
I think I was like that with Joe.
and that can be very difficult sometimes. Yeah. So if he was angry, it would... And and upset on stage about something, usually about a technical thing or just the way something sounded, it would be very nerve-wracking for everybody.
So was that something then that you were looking forward to not having to deal with?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
And has it proved to be that way? Have the pros outweighed the cons, or do you miss being part of a unit? Do you feel unpleasantly exposed on your own?
I generally feel a lot more relaxed and comfortable as, you know, in my role is like getting to tell other people, oh, can you turn that amp down, and not someone, and having someone say, okay, and not being like, no, I'm not going to fucking turn my amp. Like, it's generally more pleasant for me.
Yeah. And the music sounds very different as well. I mean, when you were in the Fiery Furnaces, how did that work? Were you both on the same page musically? Would he sort of make these crazy collages and then you would write lyrics for them? Or
It was different all the time. I mean, it was sometimes how I write songs now, or it's just I'll, you know, have a chord structure and a melody and lyrics, and I would give that to my brother, and he would either elaborate or completely tear it apart and rearrange everything, or just, you know, add flourishes, kind of like instrumental flourishes. Or sometimes I would just hand him a piece of paper with the lyrics, and he would set the lyrics to music. Sometimes he would say, here's the song, sing it. Sometimes he would say, well, I've got this. Do you want to add anything or change? You know, so we had a few different ways of working together. But overall, I mean, I'm totally fine with saying he was absolutely the, you know, music director of the band and really set the tone for how our band sounded. And, you know, although we had a back and forth about lots of things, I mean, he almost always won out. But he was also always, I have to give him credit, always asking me, like, what do you want to do next? What do you want to tell me? You know, he's always asking me. And if I was able to make something happen, that's a little bit unclear now in my memory. Or if it was just like him winning, not an agenda, but just, you know, doing what he thought was best. For instance, like, we started playing sets that had no pauses at all. So we would play for like 60 minutes just without stopping at all. And at first we got a lot of flack for it because people would say, like, you know, we want to clap between the songs. We want to hear, you know. And my brother felt very strongly that that's how we should play. And we weren't breaking new ground. I mean, that's something that has been done in popular music, you know, forever. But people reacted like it was something terrible and annoying. And that sort of reaction just made my brother want to do it even more.
Right.
And at first I was like, is this right? But then I got really into it. And it was almost like a sporting event for me. It was just this, you know, endurance test. And it was exciting.
Didn't that leave you completely shredded after shows, though?
It did, yeah. And then I was just happy to just like sing a song and stop. And like I said, I hated people tuning their guitars, but like tuning a guitar and saying something to the audience. And that was like a novelty to me when I first started playing on my own. But now I've kind of gone back to tonight I'm going to play, and I've made up this set mostly just to amuse myself and kind of going back to that Fiery Furnaces way of playing. And I'm doing a lot of like transitions from song to song. And if a song ends in A, then, well, what's the next song that I know that starts in A so I can just keep playing? And I've kind of gone back to that more and more.
Mm. One of the songs that made a big impression on me early on from Fiery Furnaces was Chief Inspector Blanchflower,
mm-hmm,
from 2004, Blueberry Boat.
That's a song my brother wrote.
Okay. I mean, that is very odd. It's a very odd song. I mean, it's like a little mini opera, isn't
it? Yeah. That's something that, you know, my brother was very interested in doing. He still wants to, you know, write rock operas. Pete Townsend was his absolute hero as a kid, and he wanted to write many rock operas in that sort of Who tradition.
Did he write all the words on that one?
On Chief Inspector Blanchflower.
I mean,
that's like three. I'm trying to remember. I think he did write all the words.
It's fucking mental stuff, though, isn't it?
I mean, well, literally, the first kind of character in the song is mental.
Okay.
So to speak. I had a dexedrine, hyperactivity selective, attend to relevant information, tempo taken in toll to mechanism, coping concept, put my head down, crumple my paper. My brother used to work with children with disabilities as a part-time job. And actually, when the band really took off, whatever it did, he was getting his teaching certificate to work with children with disabilities. So he worked with a lot of kids with cerebral palsy and nonverbal kids. And that beginning part of that song is, I think, from the perspective of one of those kids.
Yeah. And then it's.
Does
then
that
it,
make any sense?
It does. Yes, it does. He's trying to sort of put himself in the mind of
special needs
special
children.
Special needs, yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting and odd. And then you kind of alternate, you take turns, mm-hmm. the perspective shifts throughout the song, and then it sort of gets a bit more conventional.
And then suddenly we're like in Scotland.
Right. Dumbarton Dip.
Dampin' Dumbarton Dip, about the 14th of May. The publican dropped me a line, thought there had been foul play. The farmer up the hill came in with his knife. He mumbled something darkly about his young wife.
It is like a play, and a lot of those songs, I mean, that's another big difference between what I was doing then and what I'm doing now, and for better or worse, I mean, I did kind of feel like I was an actor, and I, you know, my job as the singer was to really put these weird songs across, you know, and to make them feel real for the audience. And now I'm singing these songs that, you know, maybe I'm the actor, but I'm also, you know, mostly singing from my own perspective and sharing pretty intimate details about my life and the lives of, you know, other people who I know.
Some of your lyrics have the feel of a journal entry or a phone conversation.
Yeah.
Do you keep a journal?
Sometimes I do.
And do you raid it for songs?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely raid emails and texts. And if I hear something someone says, either someone I know or don't know, I write it down if I think I could use it later.
Has that ever caused any problems? Does it make you worry about people feeling misrepresented or hearing something that they realize, hang on, that was something I said to Eleanor?
No, I don't worry about it.
All right, good. I'm just trying to stir things up. Because, yeah, there's lots of great little details in there. Like, that was when I knew from your album Personal Record.
I met her in my bedroom, oh, at a party Halloween. And she was wearing a pair of overalls, so I sang Come On Eileen. Oh, I was being slightly mean, and that just made her smile, which made me feel childish. Yeah.
That seems to be, from my point of view, about a woman you met who ended up being a bandmate or playing in a band.
Do you want to know the truth? Or I mean, do you want me to... this is a big question, actually. Do you want to know the truth?
Well, I mean, that makes me just completely small-minded, like I have to just...
Not small-minded, but I mean, you have a story in your mind, so do you want to keep that?
Can I have both?
No, because if I tell you something, then...
It'll be replaced.
Yeah, and I feel like it's better for you to keep your story.
I know that would be the mature thing to do, but I'm not.
Because what are you going to gain from that?
An insight into my ability to decode your lyrics. I want to have them confirmed. No. I'm telling you what I think it is.
Okay, good. I want you to keep thinking what
right.
you think.
Okay. I think it's a bandmate that you had a crush on,
okay.
and that and that made your life difficult for a
Interesting.
While. Interesting. He didn't mention his mother from your current album. Now, this is a line that I know people have quoted back at you a lot.
I can still see you sitting on the edge of the bed, looking at me like it was something.
So that line in itself, it's like, whoa, is this... Because I think everyone's been in that position, either being the one looking at the other person and looking as if it was something, or being the other person thinking, oh, you thought that was something. So is that, I'm thinking like, is that her being pleased that he thinks it's something? Or is that her thinking, mate, that was not something? Presumably there's supposed to be an ambiguity there, right?
Mm.
Walk over the bridge and keep walking ahead of you. You've just had a shag. You go out and it's early days in the relationship.
Yeah.
You're going for a walk.
Yeah.
And you're walking ahead of him. You're maybe walking briskly because you don't want to tag behind and have an intimate chat and maybe have to hold hands and I don't know.
Maybe he's not even on the bridge.
Right. He hasn't even got to the bridge yet. Well, he's back in the flat still, and you're plowing across the bridge thinking, whoa, fucking, what was that? I so wanted something to happen that day. And then what I wanted, it happened. And it just don't always happen that way to me. Oh, no.
Hey, I've got an idea. How about tonight? I just play guitar. I just work on my guitar, and you just do a spoken word.
I'm happy to do that.
Kind of session over
Certainly.
The top.
Happy to do it.
That never sounded so good.
There's a lot going on in there, isn't there? As you say, that's the joy of music and those kinds of lyrics and poetry, is that you slot them into your own experiences.
Right. I mean, that's the hope, you know?
Yeah. Your stuff is good for doing that, I must say. And there's a lot of kind of romantic yearning. A lot of it reminds me, I mean, now I'm now like mid-40s, married, children.
Life's over.
Well, that part of my life is over. You know what I mean? I don't mind. I've come to terms with that. And there's many, many great things that you get instead of that.
Yeah. No, I think that is a big difference between... I'm not married.
Yeah.
And that kind of... That is the best word. The yearning is an extremely powerful emotion that is very good for writing songs in the sort of tradition that I'm writing songs in. It's a lot about yearning. And it helps that that still happens in my real life, you know. And if it didn't, you know, I would hopefully find something else to write about, but...
Yeah. Sport.
Yeah, playing softball, probably.
It's musical performance time on the podcast.
Go studio.
Will you introduce it?
This is called He Didn't Mention His Mother.
I feel just as crazy as I did last night. I feel like I'll get up and go. Today I'm frozen, but tomorrow I'll write about you. A friend and her baby and a dog that I know. I got nothing done, that's the way. On the roof, in the attic, or out the window, was it you? A mouse, a bear, or a bug? A house, a chair, and a rug? A mouse, a bear, or a bug? Was it you? Was it you? I can still see you sitting on the edge of the bed, looking at me like it was something. Walk over the bridge and keep walking ahead of you. I so wanted something to happen that day, and then what I wanted, it happened. And that just don't always happen that way to me. Oh no. A mouse, a bear, above. I has a chair and a rug. A mouse, a bear, or a bug. Yes, it's you, oh yes, it's you.
If you're okay with that, I'm okay with
that. That's great, yeah, thank you so much.
No, no problem.
Wait.
This is an advert for Squarespace. Hey guys, it's Broshak with me, Paul Broshak. We got Mike here. We're going to talk about his new MMA comedy special. We're going to talk about his view counts, and we're going to talk about conspiracy theories. What's up, Mike?
Hello, Paul.
Hey, brother.
I'm fine, thank you. I don't want to talk about any of those things anymore.
You don't?
No. I want to talk about... I built a website, Paul.
All right. Stream some fights, settle some beefs, stick it to the elites, that kind of thing.
No. It's mainly dog pictures, Paul. And I did it on Squarespace. Have you heard of Squarespace? I went to squarespace.com/Buxton and I did a free trial. And I tried some of the beautiful templates, Paul, and I typed things in. I dragged in pictures of the dogs. And before I knew it, I had a website, Paul. So I bought it and I've made some very sweet dog t-shirts and I sell those on the shop on the website.
Uh-huh. But do you still fight and stuff?
A little bit, but not really. Oh, and Paul, I wanted to tell you that when it comes time to buy your website or domain on Squarespace, if you use the offer code Buxton, you save 10%. Paul.
Thanks, Mike. Where'd you do that free trial?
Squarespace.com/Buxton.
And how sweet were the dogs?
Very.
Continue.
Welcome back, Podcats. Thank you very much to Eleanor Friedberger for giving up her time to talk to me and to play that lovely song. Thanks very much to Richard Walsh for helping to set up the meeting. A reminder that Eleanor's excellent album, Rebound, is out now. And if you feel inspired to further explore her work and the Fiery Furnaces back catalogue, there's a few links to some bits and pieces that you may find interesting on the description to this podcast, including that article from The Quietus about Eleanor's favourite albums that you can listen to right the way through, and that performance of Police Sweater Blood Vow with her brother Matthew that I mentioned, and a few other bits and pieces. You can probably click on those links from your device, and depending on what kind of device you have, they may take you to the relevant places. But if you visit my blog, adam-buxton.co.uk, and click on the podcasts tab, then open up the relevant episode, it should work like a blog post and be even more user-friendly, I hope. So look, if you're still listening to this episode, I imagine that you are open-minded music enthusiasts, so I had a couple of recommendations for you. I was watching this week and last week a couple of great music documentaries that I thought I would mention. One of them is called Hip Hop Evolution. It's a documentary from 2016 that first aired on HBO in Canada, and it can now be seen on Netflix. Both of these docs that I'm going to mention are on Netflix. I'm not sponsored by Netflix, by the way. I'm not obliged to sing their praises. I just happen to have seen these shows on there. As I was saying to Eleanor, I do love music documentaries, but I feel as though at this point I might have seen all the footage shot in CBGBs ever, and I probably have heard every single classic rock band breakup story from the 60s to the present day. So as I'm not a hip-hop expert by any stretch, this was like finding a huge glittering Trevor Trove. It should be noted that, like any doc that sets out to tell the story of a whole movement, it's bound to have glaring omissions and biases that serious fans would take issue with. No Salt and Pepper, MC Light, or Queen Latifah, for example. And why does the series not mention Nas's Illmatic and skate over the cultural impact of Luther Campbell and the Miami bass sound? I'm just reading out bits from a review I saw at this point. But there's an awful lot of other stuff in the 4-hour-long episodes that is fascinating and totally joyful, whether or not you love hip-hop. There's wonderful bits of archive that I'd never seen before, from the early 70s through to the early 90s, as well as a few bits that you have seen but you don't mind seeing again. And nearly all the interviewees are terrific value. I particularly fell in love with Daryl DMC McDaniels. I didn't realise that DMC was just Daryl McDaniels. Someone at school told me it was direct metal cutting. Oh yeah, Run DMC, it's direct metal cutting. It's like a technique that they use to make that. Okay. No, it's just Daryl McDaniels. And he's just about the most sparkly, youthful, self-effacing fellow you could ever hope to meet. He just seems terrific. He's worth watching the whole thing for alone, but there's so many other characters in there who are equally charming and interesting and funny. So yeah, I would recommend Hip Hop Evolution. Biases and omissions notwithstanding. Also highly entertaining, though in a very different way, was another four-part documentary that features a wealth of amazing archive and interviews again, and this one's called The Defiant Ones. Quoting now from the description, The Defiant Ones tells of the unbreakable bond of trust and friendship between music legends Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre, two street-smart men from different worlds who together defied traditional wisdom and transformed contemporary culture in the process. So it's the story of how these two found each other. First of all, Jimmy Iovine's early life as an engineer and producer for artists like John Lennon and Bruce Springsteen and Tom Petty and Patti Smith, Stevie Nicks, and then Dr. Dre. Obviously, it sort of picks up almost where the hip-hop doc left off, although they do cover his very early days being part of a much more glam and silly-looking outfit than NWA ended up being. But then you cover the NWA years and the Chronic and the change that album made and then the years beyond of gangster rap when things got serious and dark with Biggie and Tupac and Suge Knight and all those characters. And the two, Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre, come together and form this label, Interscope. Now, I might be getting some of the details wrong here. You'd have to watch the doc. But the labels Interscope and Death Row feature very heavily in the documentary. And a lot of those artists on there are interviewed. Snoop Dogg and Eminem. Gwen Stefani from No Doubt. Will.i.am from the Black Eyed Peas, Trent Reznor from Nine Inch Nails, Marilyn Manson is mentioned, though not interviewed. So there's lots of interesting characters popping up. Although that kind of music was never my favourite, really, it's still very interesting to watch this doc. And unlike Hip Hop Evolution, which to me was a celebration of creativity and a look at some of the social conditions at the time that fostered that creativity, The Defiant Ones is much more the story of the relationship between business and creativity. And more than anything, it's a story about two blokes who made a shitload of money in ways that were sometimes quite questionable. And it's not a total hagiography, this doc. You do get a sense of some of the nastier and more cynical aspects of the music industry and the personalities involved. But yeah, I thought it was very entertaining, very interesting. Occasionally a bit depressing. What do you think, Rose?
I don't feel that Snoop Dogg represents me as a member of the dog community, and I still find some of his lyrics highly offensive. But on the plus side, I did lie on my back on the sofa with my paws in the air and my head hanging off the side while I was watching this. So that was really good. I enjoyed that.
That was a much better and more concise review than mine.
Yes, all right, you're welcome.
All right. Let's head back and enjoy the rest of the sunshine. Thank you very much indeed to Seamus Murphy Mitchell for his production input on this episode. Thanks once again to Eleanor Friedberger for talking to me, for making the time and for her patience. And thanks most especially to you, Podcats, for listening right to the end. Might be a bit warm for a hug. Should we just go for a snooty Euro kiss? Mwah, mwah, mwah. Till next time we're together. Oh, beautiful bird action. Please go carefully. And remember, I love you. Bye!
Like and subscribe. Please like and subscribe.
Check out this mad techno bird. This is one bird making all this noise, flying around. Wicked.